And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. You know it's coming. Perhaps you've already seen it, or perhaps you will soon. This week, we'll be talking about Iron Man 3, the suit, the fights, and the meaning of it all. We'll also touch on an always touchy subject, the things we've given up on trying to like. And as always, we'll talk about what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And we have with us this week Matt Thompson, our pal.
Hey,
Matt Thompson.
Yeah. Hey.
Now, Matt, since we last spoke to you, you have a new project at NPR.
I do.
You have an entire new gig. You're a king.
I wouldn't put it quite that way. But
tell us about what you are doing now.
So my title is the Manager of Digital Initiatives and Mischief. And in that capacity, I'm leading a team. I've built a new team to cover race, ethnicity, and culture for NPR.
And this is the team that's doing the Code Switch blog.
Yeah, yes. Built a dynamite team.
Which we have spoken about a couple times on this show and how much we love it and appreciate it and think it's awesome.
Thank you. We also have frequent conversations about how much we love you and
aww,
your blog.
It's
and
just,
our show.
You knucklehead.
It's just one big hug party here. But we're always happy to have Matt with us, in part because Matt is, Matt's an experienced superhero comics reading sort of a guy. And I think was here for one of our previous Iron Man shows.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least one of our previous summer blowout shows.
I love that we have just special Iron Man themed episodes every now and then.
That's right. Well, I think
my kind of podcast.
Matt is one of our Iron Man correspondents. We should mention, as we talk about this film, we will try not to give away the big surprises of the film, such as they are.
There are fights.
Right. There are
explosions.
But you should be aware that, we've seen it. If you are one of these people who doesn't want to know anything, this might not be the segment for you. So you might go ahead to our next one. So, with that said, Matt, what did you think of Iron Man 3, the latest in the Marvel Universe, the latest in the adventures of Tony Stark? What did you think?
I found myself liking it. I was pleasantly surprised by some of the racial geopolitic subtext of the movie.
Yeah.
That sort of rapidly became text as the movie goes on.
Right.
And I thought it was well-paced. I think Robert Downey Jr. is just super watchable and incredibly charming.
Yeah, I think he is too.
I read somewhere that I believe this is either the fifth or sixth straight year in which Robert Downey Jr. is the star of a movie that makes more than $500 million.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
I mean, think about it, between the Iron Man movies,
the Avengers,
and the Sherlock Holmes movies.
Oh, yeah.
He's on this ridiculous tear. Like, you would not have seen that coming 10 years ago.
Definitely.
No,
nope.
Definitely not.
Not since Chances Are.
Gosh, I will say, I love Chances Are.
Of course you do.
I love that movie. Anyway, Glenn, what did you think of Iron Man 3?
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I think you can tell that you're in the hands of an action director, because these films are essentially comedies with action in them.
Right.
And that they really distinguishes them from other superhero films like, say, The Dark Knight, which is not a comedy.
Right.
Remotely. Can't even crack a smile. I think the action in this film felt a lot more grounded, a lot more real. In The Avengers, where the big destruction, the big violence, the big action happens on a flying helicarrier, and B, you're destroying New York City, which we've seen a lot, it kind of leaves the realm of action and goes into spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I lose a little emotional contact with it. It just feels like the connection I have with it is intellectual. It's like, well, that looks impressive.
Yeah.
And here, the action set pieces were really a scene of a missile attack. I really felt that in a way I haven't really felt action in a movie before. So really strong.
For me, one of the things that's interesting about this movie is that one of my issues with Iron Man 2 was that I was so disengaged from and uninterested in robots fighting.
Yeah. Mm.
Because Iron Man 2, you really wind up with two big robots fighting each other.
Robot on robot. Well, in Real Steel, it's not so bad.
Robot boxing is fine, but this was like robots throwing fire at each other. And
right.
I was completely on...
It doesn't feel human.
It doesn't feel...
With pulsar rays,
right.
Not
it,
fire.
It doesn't feel interesting to me. And so it was really fascinating to see that while in Iron Man 2, they got very into everybody in the suits all the time. Because between Iron Man and then the bad guy and then the appearance of what's now the Iron Patriot or whatever they're calling him, the Don Cheadle character, there's just suits everywhere. And in this movie, they get everybody out of the suits.
Right.
And Downey is spending most of this movie out of the suit. Mm-hmm. Cheadle is spending the back half of this movie in a polo shirt and jeans, which I love.
Right.
I love the timelessness of your best friend is running around in a polo shirt and jeans, and that's your pal.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really interesting to me to see kind of go from one extreme where there's way too much suit to here where there's much, much less suit. What did you think, Stephen?
I liked it. I wasn't quite as rah-rah in my praise. I felt, I've said on the show before that I'm a little superheroed out in the movies. I did think it was interesting, and I think this is a good time to bring in a discussion of the director of the film, Shane Black,
mm-hmm.
who is very heavily associated with action movies, primarily screenplays.
Right.
He wrote The Last Boy Scout. He wrote some version of The Last Action Hero. It's
right.
kind of hard to give him the blame for that one.
Right.
And of course, when he was in his early 20s, he wrote the screenplay for Lethal Weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And I did find myself, as much as I wasn't sitting there thinking about Shane Black, I was at various points thinking about the fact that this feels less like a superhero movie and more like an action movie.
Right.
That superhero movies certainly have sort of replaced the ridiculous, over-the-top, completely implausible action movie. I mean, I wonder how deliberate it was. I felt like there were scenes and set pieces in the movie that were specifically recalling old action movies.
Sure.
And not iconic old action movies. There's a set piece in the movie where a bunch of people are being rescued falling out of a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reminiscent to me of a scene in the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie Eraser.
Sure.
With a similarly ridiculously implausible bit where mm-hmm. somebody's falling out. Even the help of the Bieber-haired helmet Muppet was very reminiscent to me of The Last Action Hero, where there's a bunch of stuff with a kid.
Yeah.
Well, another thing, it's like a Bond movie challenge in some ways because of the nature of Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. He's this, you know, somewhat detached. He's, above all things, he's kind of charming. Everything's kind of a punchline to him. So for those emotionally freighted moments that might ordinarily propel an action movie. I mean, if you think about, you know, Batman's angst or, mm-hmm. you know, Superman's placelessness in the world, his
right.
ultimate outcast shtick, Iron Man and Robert Downey Jr. doesn't have that kind of emotional weight to him. He has to, in these big emotional moments, still be sort of detached and charming and mm-hmm. have a punchline at the ready. And
yeah.
so the action sequences kind of ramp up the emotional intensity of those moments in a way that you can't count on his character to do.
Right.
Right.
A lot of scenes in this film between two actors where they're given room to breathe, their dialogue is given room to kind of overlap, so it has an improvisational feel. In one scene in particular, whenever Tony Stark has an anxiety attack, when we see it in a dream, we can actually see images from mm-hmm. the Avengers film. But for the rest of those anxiety attacks, we don't get what we would normally get in a movie like this. We don't get flashbacks. We don't get music. We don't get the sound effects. We just see an actor acting.
Mm-hmm.
The entirety of the anxiety attack is just the director trusting his actor. And that's very unusual. You feel like, you know, in a movie like this, they're going to throw all the kind of tropes and tricks at you. But there was some really surprising moments that didn't feel like they were locked into a formula.
Yeah. And I have to say, as I was watching it, I had the very conscious thought, I would be completely fine with a Best Actor nomination for Robert Downey Jr. in one of these movies. Hmm. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But for me, the ability to put, as Matt was saying, Iron Man is a different kind of guy. He doesn't have these sort of external conflicts and he doesn't have existential angst and all that stuff. He has to be brought low in some way. And obviously this movie, there's an entire process of stripping him of all of these things
right.
and then seeing what happens to him, which, and this is one of the things I wrote about on the blog today, is part of the conversation he has with Captain America and the Avengers. When Captain America sort of says, without all this stuff, what are you?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you're all
stuff gadgets and toys.
And no character. To me, this feels, despite the fact that it's different directors and different writing and stuff like that, it really feels like a continuation of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because that tension between them in the Avengers is never really resolved. It's still, I mean, they learn to cooperate and all that stuff, but it's never really resolved. And this is almost the next phase of that argument of the who is this guy and is there anything to you without your stuff? And here he is without a lot of his stuff a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And then he has to kind of figure out Who Are You Then?
It's a 2-hour and 15-minute movie. I'm going to say he's in the suit maybe 15 minutes of that 2 hours
yeah,
and 15.
Yeah, it's not a lot.
There's a scene where he has part of the suit on, an incredibly well choreographed, very fun scene where he only has certain bits of it. It was really, really good. The other thing, I think this might be the first superhero film to ever pass the Bechdel test. This has been, I think, brought up on Salon today, but I thought of it first. And that's A. B, okay, not since Catwoman has a superhero film passed the Bechdel test. So you have these two characters, Maya and Pepper. Doesn't seem like they should pass just based on the names alone.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, let's give it to them. Where these two women sit down and have a scene, a brief scene, and talk about something besides a man.
Mm-hmm.
And in this dude-heavy universe, that was surprising.
Fully along those lines, I was amazed that we had a 2-hour and 15-minute movie that was fundamentally about a man getting into and out of his clothes.
Right.
sort of a feminist milestone right there, I think.
That's right. This picks up on my shirtlessness theory. If there's shirtlessness in a superhero film, it's going to be good. And we had some Guy Pearce. We had a lot of Guy Pearce shirtlessness.
We did have some Guy Pearce shirtlessness.
He was glowing orange at the time.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I was pleased about this movie. I had gone into this movie, as we've discussed on this podcast, with a few reservations pertaining to the weightiness.
Right.
A hero's fall. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to watch a hero's fall. I want to watch things, I want to watch fighting and stuff.
or, as in this case, wardrobe wars.
Mm. Right. And I was pleased that it wasn't The Dark Knight Rises.
Right.
That's primarily what I was worried about. And I felt like the villainy was more interesting than in The Dark Knight Rises. Everything about it I liked better than The Dark Knight Rises.
He's a resilient character. So even when he is knocked out and laid low, you pretty soon after get glimmers of his sense of humor, his incredible resourcefulness. And that's really the thing that I find satisfying about this character and the way they construct the world he lives in is that on the one hand, he is the man who has everything, which is why he has to be brought low. But then when he has everything and he's brought low, he's very good at then figuring out what to do next, goes around and meets up with this kid and asks the kid for certain things. I very much enjoyed that. And I was really glad that the kid does not become kind of a sidekick for the whole movie.
Right.
The
kid is not in the whole... He's really in a section of the movie and then reappears
He doesn't reunite the kid with his estranged father.
It's not short round. You know what I mean?
Right.
He's not following him around through the whole movie going... The left tunnel. He's not like that. He shows up. He has a function like everybody else. He shows up. He has a function. And the main sidekick remains the Don Cheadle character,
right.
Rhodes/. I keep thinking Iron Patriot, which is so bad of me. War Machine.
War Machine.
No. Iron Patriot is right, though.
Yeah, Iron Patriot's right.
He's both.
Yeah. War Machine.
Yeah. War Machine.
They changed it.
So Shane Black, even his most macho films have an element of self-parody to them. Like, he's a guy who gets it, a guy who's in on the joke. So the entire fact that we see these two dudes just running around an oil rig with guns, it's a very Lethal Weapon. It's very, it's another callback, I think. Mm-hmm. It's another callback to at least that dynamic of the buddy cop film.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, Shane Black went through his own kind of career collapse and resurrection. And interestingly, this is only the second movie he's actually directed. And I think it's very easy to think of him entirely associated with these bloated, big budget. He was paid $4 million for a script for a movie that tanked, blah, blah, blah. But the other movie that he directed is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which basically resurrected Robert Downey Jr.'s career.
Yeah,
went a long way anyway. Yeah.
And it's pretty clear, in part, that there's a favor being repaid there.
Mm. Sure. And I think that there is sometimes that feeling between directors and actors that if you work well together, you may see these people together again, even in a very, very different kind of arrangement. And while we're talking about the callbacks, to me, the funniest callback in the movie and the most entertaining is the closing credits, which are basically like a Stephen J. Canal cop show from the 70s or 80s.
Very Hardcastle and McCormick.
And not, like Stephen said, not the kind of stuff that you would think great classics, but just the kind of stuff that a lot of these people would have watched, like Beretta and that kind of There are these freeze-framey credits. You'll see it if you haven't seen the movie yet. When you see it, it'll be 100% obvious to you what I'm talking about, because it's a kind of credit sequence that nobody makes anymore.
Right.
And they got every single piece of it right, the way that each actor is shown in a bunch of little things, including usually a very quick little smile.
Yep.
And it's so well done, and it's so loving, and it really reminded me of Django Unchained, mm-hmm. how Django Unchained includes not only the musical references to other genres, but also, as we talked about at the time, the casting of Lee Horsley and, whoever.
Don Johnson.
And Don Johnson and some of these other guys, that you had those guys in there as a nod to not just classic, brilliant action, mm-hmm. but sort of lovable, populist, workmanlike action. And those closing credits struck me as the same way.
What did we think of the villainy?
I think the villainy is interesting. This is a little tricky to talk about because you don't want to give away too much about the villainy. But they set up pretty early in the movie that Guy Pearce is certainly a bad guy.
Right.
And, you know, he's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. There's this film is playing with tone a lot because it is comedy and it's action. And some of the stuff that Ben Kingsley's character gets up to is very, very dark. And then that takes a kind of a turn. But I really thought you see the twist coming. Mm-hmm. And it's welcome when it arrives, because you didn't want this to go down that somber Bane.
Of course.
I was really afraid that he was going to be Bane and he was going to turn up every 2 seconds
to
growl at us.
I liked the villainy. I thought, just as Glenn said, I think that they sort of telegraphed things pretty nicely, and then actually they took you someplace with their villains. I found myself after the movie considering my reaction to the first impressions that I had of the movie's villains, mm-hmm. and thinking, boy, I'm happy that turned out differently.
Yeah. That could have gone a lot worse. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the next logical step is to briefly consider how excited we are for the next Thor movie, which is the next Marvel movie is Thor 2,
Yep, it's coming down the pike very quickly.
Well, there's also The Wolverine.
Oh, yeah.
Wolverine. But from this, Avengers team.
I know.
Thor is my least favorite, the thing. Yeah.
Just because it's gods wailing on each other?
Yeah, I just didn't care that much. I only cared about Thor when it was completely the Earthbound stuff with the scientists and all that. Who was it? Natalie Portman
and Kat Dennings.
That I care about. The rest of it I didn't care about at all. I'm not super excited about seeing Thor again. I felt he was the most boring part of the Avengers.
Okay. I don't disagree strongly. I did like the Thor movie a lot more than you did. But I did think that the stuff in Asgard was hard to relate to and just sort of...
Well, it's hard to relate.
You anyway.
Yeah.
It's hard to relate to these space gods.
For me, pretty much the sole redemption of the Thor movie is that it's also the Loki movie. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that's fair.
Yeah, I found myself, because I saw the trailer for Thor 2 before Iron Man 3. And I definitely thought I saw Thor.
Yeah, I saw Thor. And that was the experience that I mentioned. The funny thing is that's the same experience I mentioned having about Iron Man 2 shortly after I saw it.
Yeah.
I had the experience of being like, I saw Iron Man 2, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. I did. I saw Iron Man 2.
I have found overall with a lot of superhero movies, they don't generally stick with me hard.
Yeah.
They tend to blur together in my head. It's a lot of CGI. It's a lot of metal clanging into metal and throwing off sparks. I even found it the first time they referred to in this movie to his terrible, terrible memories of New York. I'm like, was that Iron Man 2?
Yeah.
Oh, it was the Avengers.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It took me a second, too.
And even though I loved the Avengers, I was blown away by the Avengers, but it has not really dug.
Yeah.
As much as it is a gigantic spectacle and one of the biggest hit movies of all time, it isn't necessarily burrowed into my consciousness the way other movies do.
Well, and this weekend they had a bridge here in D.C. closed, and they kept saying on the radio that it was closed for the next Captain America movie.
Because
they're filming the next... Now, that I'm excited about.
Now, Stephen Thompson, I owe you an apology because here I predicted something you would say. Matt, you want to read that?
It was too long. Wah, boo, hoo, wah. enough.
So you didn't say it. You alluded to it.
It was too
long. I do often find movies to be too long. I often find that a movie, why be an hour and 45 minutes when you can be 2 hours and 20 minutes? But this I thought was well, I thought it was nicely paced. And I brought both of my kids, including a 9-year-old who was not squirming in her seat.
Good, okay. The middle section in the small town included some scenes that weren't necessarily necessary, but this goes back to what we were talking about earlier. World building, Linda Holmes.
Oh.
You don't care for it, but it's part of the deal.
No, I enjoyed the small town part. It tends to be the big world building at the beginning of superhero movies that I get a little bit impatient. I get it. Just tell me who the good guy is and who the bad guys are. And tell me everyone wants the cube. That's fine. I can take it on faith. If you just had a guy who came in and it was like the beginning of Star Wars and you had a crawl where they just explained, this is the cube. Or if they had a little PowerPoint, this is the cube. Everyone wants the cube. Got it? I would say, got it. And then you can go.
And the title card comes up and robots are wailing at each other.
Like the one person that is totally fine with just the exposition being exposition. Right. Just like,
it's like,
bring
just,
it on.
Just tell me everybody wants the cube. And then when I see people fighting, I'll be like, well, one of them has the cube.
I mean,
and the other one wants
it. I feel like I saw the trailer for Fast and Furious 6. And I sort of sensed that that's what's happening there. That they'll do a really quick ramp up and then cars will fly off bridges into other cars.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be the, this car's got to get over here. Cool? Yeah, cool. I like low concept. This is why my favorite action movie is Speed. If the bus goes under 50, it'll blow up. Cool.
Yeah.
Got
speed,
it.
Speed and Die Hard.
Got, yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
That's
got
why
it.
One might describe Iron Man 3 as speed in a wardrobe.
There you go.
Yeah, it's true. If the wardrobe slows down, it'll explode. Well, you can come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH and tell us what you thought of Iron Man, villainy, fashion, and whether you are excited about Thor 2, which, you know, who knows? We'll have to just see. Okay, so our other topic this week, we wanted to talk about the things that we have tried to like, but we have given up. Now, Glenn, what were you calling this segment? You were calling this segment, I believe...
I can't with this.
I can't with this anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh. So we're just going to go around and have a little chat about some of this stuff. Stephen, what did you bring?
I've talked briefly on this show before about having given up American Idol.
Right.
And it certainly was the first thing that came to my mind, is that there was a tipping point somewhere along the way in which for me, unfortunately, not only American Idol, but The Voice, which is a vastly superior show, and The X Factor, which is a probably roughly equivalent show, I just reached an I can't anymore moment with all of these singing shows. And I watch a crap ton of reality television, but for whatever reason, the melisma and the judging and all that, I just hit a point where it was an I can't. And I was trying to think about why. And it's not just about the show's quality, but it is about their cultural importance and the lessening of. And when these shows are so plentiful and not actually producing gigantic hit artists, they reach a point where I'm like, well, then I'm out. Because for me, what was always interesting about American Idol was that it would periodically produce gigantic cultural phenomena.
You know, well, and then you could argue with people about who you liked and who you didn't like. And
people would know what you were talking about. And I was thinking about tipping points that cause cultural phenomena to disappear. Mm-hmm. And one of them really was where the supply tilts way too heavily over to the wrong side. And I was thinking about like a Queer Eye for the Straight Guy or The Weakest Link where... they were incredibly hot.
Those are ones where they showed them too much.
Yeah, they were incredibly hot. They were shown way too much.
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was on, I think, four nights a week.
Wow.
And so for me, actually, it was a Wipeout. You know how much I love Wipeout. But when Wipeout suddenly was on year-round, Wipeout didn't mean it's summer anymore. I want Wipeout to be like, it's June 3rd, time to watch people hitting things and landing on other things.
Yeah.
And so that restraint in programming, once that restraint in programming goes away, that's for me a big point at which I find myself quitting certain elements of pop culture.
Yeah. And now you just don't know who the good singers are.
And now I have no idea who the gigantic superstars of tomorrow are.
Now you have no strong opinion about the input.
Who are the lead devices of tomorrow?
You have no strong opinion about the input provided by Harry Connick Jr.
I have none.
I have many.
I have liked it in the past.
I have many strong opinions. I tend to share them all on Twitter, though. How about you, Matt?
So I reached this moment the other day, and I realized it. I was watching Breaking Bad. I've been watching Breaking Bad for all five seasons of Breaking Bad so far, and it's been difficult. We've definitely slowed the pace. My partner and I, this is one of the shows that we watch together, and we watch, we're time shifted. We're watching it through Amazon Video. So we've definitely developed a longer and longer break between each episode because we needed more time to recuperate.
Yeah, it's true. They get a little dark at times.
It gets a little dark at times. And there was just one moment at the end of one episode where Walt just does something that it took us probably 2 months before we were willing to,
before you
watch,
wanted to watch
another
Walt
episode.
Yeah.
I have the same thing with Donald Trump in The Apprentice. When he fired LaToya Jackson, I was like, I'm out.
You're done. But yeah, I mean, it reached that point where I felt like I was still intellectually appreciating this work of art, but I was too emotionally bludgeoned at that point to continue.
You were not taking any pleasure in it.
I was taking no pleasure in it.
Yeah.
And I actually said it out loud to Brian. Brian, I think I'm done.
Wow.
It's
so close to being over.
Yeah.
Don't you feel like you should complete it? Given that it's actually a good show. It's not like Trey quitting Smash.
My heart is saying, my heart is saying, let's go. But my head is saying no.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. Breaking Bad can be pretty punishing. And I when we get around to me, I will express further sympathy with that point of view. But first, Glenn, what did you bring?
Okay, I thought about this almost exclusively in the context of hour-long scripted dramas.
Sure.
Because there are some that I can gobble up like chocolate-covered cherries, and some that, there's a U-shaped curve.
Oh, sure okay. There is.
All right.
At the one end, you have Law & Order, which is so much about its formula that becomes the appeal, and you can just watch and watch and watch, and days can go by of just watching the same.
Judge Judy, same
exact
thing.
Iteration. At the other end of the line are this kind of scripted dramas that have a cinematic feel, what are generally called the quality dramas.
Right.
Your Sopranos, your The Wire, Breaking Bad, Justified, Bad Men, The Americans, I think, falls in this category for me. One of the men's, and you just want to watch the next one right away. But in the U, the bottom of the U, are those shows that have a formula that they iterate, but they aspire, they genuflect toward quality.
Yeah.
And this is what most of television is. So I wrote down a list of the shows that we've bailed on.
Yeah.
After maybe, in some cases, a season or in some cases, one or two episodes.
Yeah.
And they are Warehouse 13, Burn Notice, Blue Collar, Eureka, The Glades, and Fringe. Now, a lot of people will take issue with Fringe being on that list because they say after the second season it gets much better. But there's something about those shows that they're perfectly fine, but you can see the wiring. You can see the scaffolding of the show. And so this feeling of satiety, of just like, I get it.
Yeah.
I get what you're up to.
Yeah.
And there's nothing else in there to kind of pull me in like in The Wire.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that's just pure animal appeal like in Law & Order.
Yeah.
So those are the shows I bail on.
Yeah. Burn Notice is one that I watched for two seasons, I would say. I watched the first two seasons. And then I just didn't need to anymore.
Yeah, that's the feeling.
And I don't bear it any ill will.
Right.
I actually think it's a well-done show. If people wanted to jump in now and watch two seasons of it, I would say, sure, absolutely. Jump in, watch two seasons of it. I recommend it. Watch a couple seasons of it. But you will get to a point where it just doesn't feel essential to watch any more of it.
Right.
I was actually the same way about House. I watched about three seasons of House. And then I just felt like it was the same episode every time. And I had enjoyed watching that episode up to, let's say, 60 times.
Right.
But past that point. So I'm completely on board.
And you found that it really, really fed your hypochondria.
Right.
in lovely ways.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah, it's true. I did have to keep from Googling the diseases on House because I had all of them, as I always do. So what I was going to talk about, and this feels like somewhat familiar territory for me based on some of the things I've talked about in the past, but mine is Game of Thrones, actually. I tried. I did. But there is a – of all the kinds of conflict that I get sucked into, large-scale power struggles, the whole sort of like, I will rule the land for 100 years through the blood of my cousin. No, you will not, because I will rule the land for 100 years through the blood of my cousin. Oh, no, you didn't. Oh,
no, you didn't.
Go and fetch me a topless concubine. And I just, it's a whole brand of conflict that I do not get into. These clan-on-clan wars where there's lots of people killing each other and plotting and hiding behind pillars. And I watched probably more than half of the first season. I watched a bunch of it. I didn't, like, try the pilot and never go back. But I just don't care. I just don't care. I personally don't care. I couldn't get absorbed. And all of the sort of... You know, but you didn't even, there are people who, you didn't even get to the part with the creatures and the dragons and all this stuff.
No,
I'm like,
the furry feet.
You're not, that's not helping me. Like, if I don't care in the first 7 or 8 episodes and all the stuff that was always like, and then they found the wolves, but her wolf was ill. And so they had to take that small wolf and I took the runt wolf. And I so want
Mystery Science Theater 3000 style reenactments of every Game of Thrones episode by you ever. I think that would make me so happy.
It's not my thing.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones in particular, the title, at one point, fairly early on in the series, the character of Ser Jorah Mormont says to Daenerys Targaryen, like, listen, the Game of Thrones is basically this thing that goes on among these, like, 16 highfalutin people in the kingdom of Westeros. And the public, the general population, really could care less who sits in these thrones. Mm-hmm. At which point, I start to wonder, okay, so why are we caring about this again?
Why am I here? Yeah, it's a hard thing to explain, because even though Glenn was just doing his I get it, which I, you know... It's one of those shows where I don't look at it and think, how can anyone like this?
Sure.
Like I do with some kinds of shows. There are certainly some shows where I'm like, I don't like it and I don't understand why you like it. And secretly I judge you, even though I would never say that. But this show, I get why people like it. And many people who like many other things that I like also like this.
Right.
There's lots of overlap with people whose opinions I respect. I just can't. I can't.
No, I get it.
We've talked on the show before about certain things that just ping us. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't like watching violence against children. Mm-hmm. The rapiness of Game of Thrones really bugs me. Mm-hmm. So for me to overcome that bias, you know, we've talked about shows, you've talked, Linda, about shows where people get shot in the face.
Right.
And every show has people getting shot in the face. And in order to overcome
this one, it would be having your head cut off, but same thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. If you have an aversion to spurting neck cavities.
And I know you do.
So for me, it ultimately wasn't worth the squirming and, for me, genuine unpleasantness of rapiness and kid torture.
Right. So let's just clear that up. So you're against child abuse and rape.
Pound the table.
I just think it has too many goblets.
So many goblets.
I just don't watch anything with that many goblets.
Goblets.
When I see goblets, I just say, this is probably not for me.
Well, I mean, for the longest time in the first season just felt like history to me, like I was watching some boring, forgive me, PBS thing about, like, the Middle Ages, and I was like, give me some magic, throw me a bone here, and then we get the magic, then we get the, finally we get the dragons, and I am in, because I already had the maps.
I didn't make it that long.
I think the thing I like, so on the one hand, I still don't know why I'm invested in Game of Thrones. I've read all the books so far.
You have?
And I've seen the television show, and I will say, I think the television show is a better investment than the books for how much of your time they consume. But I still don't know why I'm watching exactly, and I may reach that point. I don't know why I'm reading either.
Wow.
It's like, I enjoy being in that universe to a certain extent, but I also don't feel like there's something propelling me through. There's not an arc that I'm waiting to see the conclusion of.
Waiting for every single character to die horribly.
Yes.
Yeah, I didn't make it to the dragons. I think I made it to the first mysterious egg. I think I made it to the first, like, there's something in there. It's probably not a human or a chicken.
That was your first episode. I think we see the eggs in the first episode.
I promise. All it was not a tea party. It was not a dwarf tea party situation like The Hobbit. Right?
One thing I will say for it, though, is that its use of magic and dragons and such fantastic accoutrement is... it's very grounded. It's not like all of a sudden you have the magic dragon and it unlocks the kingdom of Westeros for you. It's like... Okay, you have a dragon on the one hand that gives you sort of a good fire-breathing siege machine. But on the other hand, you've got to feed it with potentially children, and that creates moral problems for you. So there are trade-offs, like any political instrument.
Right. Or any pet, Any pets, like, you know, if you get a chinchilla, you know, it's a lovely, but then I actually know a guy who has chinchillas, so I've been learning all about how you take care of them, like that they have to have a bowl of dust to roll around in. So it's kind of like... You know, it's a trade-off with any pet. Dragon, chinchilla, whatever.
I mean, they treat it like a political instrument, like anything. It's got its pluses and minuses that are not entirely different.
Yeah. Also to Kissinger, so. Yeah.
Zing! Yeah.
That's right. And it's got a gadget of 1978.
All right. Well, you should come and find us on Facebook or on the blog and tell us what you've given up on watching. And, of course... I understand that many of you are going to be very, very, very angry at me that I kind of can't get into Game of Thrones. I understand. I'm ready.
I invested so much less time in it than you did, so they can direct their anger towards
me. If you can promise me that there won't be any more goblets, maybe I'll come back. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Two things. I finally got around to watching Rango with my beloved children and found it not only tremendously entertaining, but kind of strangely soulful. In a way that that worked for me. You talk about closing credits sequences that are gorgeous. That's a lovely movie. I enjoyed Rango. The other thing is Linda has an essay that will have gone up on the blog by the end of this week about MTV, in which she talks about MTV Unplugged, which in turn led me to go on YouTube and find, unfortunately, a bad VHS transfer, but an incredible performance that I hadn't watched in years of Mama Said Knock You Out by LL Cool J.
Don't call it a comeback!
The fact that it is not in print is like the moon landing not being in print. It is just a massively, massively, massively great, I think, sort of in terms of music history, historically pivotal moment when LL Cool J comes out there and just completely kicks ass with acoustic guitars behind him.
It is pretty great. I did go watch it after you sent me the link.
Oh my God. So rediscovering LL Cool J performing Mama Said Knock You Out in 1991
on MTV Unplugged.
Find it. It's so great.
Wonderful. Matt Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
So now that we're in this new building, I'm fairly exposed in where I sit, so I can no longer hide the fact that at least twice a day I play the music video for Janelle Monáe's Queen featuring Erykah Badu and just boogie down in my queue because it is so good. It is so good.
I can't believe all of the things they say about me. Walk in the room, they know in shade left to right. They be like, ooh.
And the video, I mean, I find it, it's one of those things, I tried running to it the other day, and I was like, yeah, this is great. Like, I'm still
sorry,
feel danceable.
I pictured you running to your computer screen to watch it.
I mean, I tried running along to the song as I jogged through the city of D.C., and I enjoyed it, but the sensory pleasure of the video is just, you gotta experience the visual artifact of Queen. By Janelle Monáe featuring Erykah Badu. The full thing, all 6 minutes, including the prelude, and the delightful moment when Erykah Badu, in the best wig ever, comes out as Badoola Oblongata. So much goodness.
Yep.
That's excited. That's what's making Matt happy this week.
It really is.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I am writing a book
book.
Uh-huh. Oh, good.
Yes, yes. It's a book that is due with a publisher in a year's time, and I might mention it once or twice on the show. You can't really, who can say if that's going to happen? Sometimes stranger things have happened. But the thing that is really making me happy, Jess Gittner hit me one time. Is the inimitable Julie Klausner. And she is singing, of course, Wig in a Box from the film and the play, Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Klausner has a podcast called How Was Your Week? It's great. She writes for Vulture. She has a YA novel out now called Art Girls Are Easy. And this is from a live version of How Was Your Week that they did at the Bell House in Brooklyn. They periodically do live shows of this podcast, and every time she sings. And there's something about that rendition of that song. It sent me back to go watch Hedwig and the Angry Inch again, which I hadn't done in years, and it still holds up. It's still a great movie. She is going to be doing some cabaret at Joe's Pub in June. The name of the cabaret act is called Too Gay for Brooklyn. And for the past 3 weeks, because this episode came out about 3 weeks ago, that song, her version of that song, has been like my gay nerd jock jam. It's the equivalent of a jock jam for people like me. It stirs the blood. It fortifies you. It gets you ready to face the day. So we'll have a link to that particular show. Also, maybe a link to some out to Hedwig because it's a great scene.
Sure.
But she's great, and that just really made me happy this week.
Wonderful, wonderful. I have no one giant thing making me happy this week. I will run down a couple of small things. I was made very happy, as we have previously referred to briefly by Harry Connick Jr.'s feedback on American Idol, which to me was as honey in my veins. He stands up, as I said on Twitter, the best part of any season of American Idol is when Harry Connick Jr. stands up and says, "Why are you singing all those dumb extra notes?" it's always my favorite part. I love it. It encourages me. Second of all, I really liked, not everybody liked, but I really liked Marc Maron's new show on IFC,
yeah,
which is called Maron. It gets a lot of comparisons to Louis, which makes sense. But for me, Louis is a little bit more embittered toward the outside. Mm. And Maron is much more, as he always is, very self-directed as far as all his anger is at himself. And in the very first episode, he went out and met a guy who was making fun of him on Twitter. And it was so painful to see. There is a little bit of a stereotype of the guy on Twitter who makes fun of you, and then it turns out he's a dork and everything.
Right.
But much more prevalent was the idea in the episode that Maron just looked ridiculous for being obsessed with people making fun of him. And to me, I expected it to be sort of self-loathing in a generic kind of neurotic way. I was surprised and impressed by the specificity of the self-loathing and how spot on I felt like it was, that he is so right that he obsesses way too much about whether people like him, mm-hmm, that is absolutely one of his weak spots. And I felt like they did a really good job. That's on IFC. It's called Maron. I got to go to two fun movie-going experiences this week. I went to the live show of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, which was this past week. And that was great fun, not just to see the taping on the screen, but also to see the audience full of NPR nerds out in force. And so that was fun. And also, I went and checked out the new Alamo Draft House way the heck out in Northern Virginia. It's far from my house, but I dragged all the way out there. Those of you who know how much I loved the Alamo theaters in Austin when I was there for South by Southwest will not be surprised that I was willing to drive 45 minutes on a weekend to check out a new Alamo Draft House. That was really fun. And finally, PBS has picked up a documentary called Only the Young, which a lot of people really liked, which came out last year. I saw it at Silver Docks almost a year ago. And it is about three sort of skateboard kids in California who have these interlocking relationships. It tends to get sold as a love triangle, which is very reductive. it's just these kids talking a lot about their lives, and the director, the people who made the film are very infatuated with Wes Anderson, so the setups look very Wes Anderson, and which drove me crazy because when they said that at the end, I was like, that's what it is. But it's called Only the Young, and it's going to be on POV in July. I'm really, really happy that PBS picked it up. It'll be on POV July 15th. I will talk about it again closer to that time, but mark it down. July 15th, POV. It's called Only the Young. I was really, really excited they picked it up.
Nice.
And those are the many things.
Yeah, you're happy this week.
I have many things. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our absent pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. I'm betting you can follow Matt Thompson on Twitter.
You can.
Where do we follow you on Twitter, Matt?
It's at mtomps, M-T-H-O-M-P-S.
You can also follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your feet to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.